having discussed, I think, the most important factor that influences biological aging, let's talk about a few other factors which also research shows have a very significant effect on how we age. The second factor I'd like to talk about is the role of exercise, because so much is written about exercise, so much is said about exercise. What does the research really show? The research shows that just because exercise is good for you, it doesn't mean that overdoing it is better. There's a lot of research now that shows that if you over-condition an athlete, they don't live as long as the normal population. In East Germany, for example, now they have deconditioning programs for Olympic athletes, because they find that those athletes who were over-conditioned have problems like cardiomyopathy, like hypertension, like arthritis, and so on. According to Ayurvedic principles, the most important thing about exercise is that it should be enjoyable. If you don't enjoy exercise, if it's a burden for you, if it's something that you really don't like doing, then in fact it could be harmful for you. The second important thing about exercise is that it should be regular, and the third important thing about exercise is it should not cause any strain on your physiology. So the best exercises, according to Ayurveda, are swimming, brisk walking, and yoga. And even if you do that three times a week, any one of these exercises, brisk walking and swimming, are the two best aerobic exercises. Jogging usually causes problems with joints, and in women it has been shown to cause prolapse of the uterus and all kinds of other problems in the internal organs. So brisk walking and swimming are the two most efficient ways to exercise, and about 30 minutes three times a week is more than enough. It brings about the physiological changes that are necessary. Going beyond that doesn't improve the situation. However, if you enjoy exercise and you like to do it more than three times a week, more than 30 minutes, the enjoyment itself is very beneficial to you. The third factor that influences aging is nutrition. We've already discussed the principles of Ayurvedic nutrition. I think one more thing I should add, and that is that a lot of research has gone into the relationship of how much we eat and how we age. And in general, it is the feeling amongst researchers that most people eat too much. In fact, Dr. Roy Walford at UCLA has done some astonishing experiments with mice. He calls it undernutrition. Actually, it's just ideal nutrition, because, again, we accept as a norm overnutrition. And he can extend the lifespan of mice almost five times their normal lifespan just by cutting down on their nutritional intake. So if we just follow the principles of Ayurvedic nutrition that we discussed previously, eating always to a level of comfort and not going beyond that, then we are doing all right. And also all the six tastes, that was very important. There's a lot of research also on the role of emotions and the biology of aging. I always come back to one very simple idea in Ayurveda, and that is, essentially, there are only two emotions. One is the experience of fear, and the other is the experience of love. Anything that you can think of as a negative emotion is a form of fear. Anxiety is a form of fear. Anger is a form of fear. Hostility is a form of fear. Resentment is an expression of fear. Greed, possessiveness, jealousy, these are all forms of fear. And the opposite of fear is the experience of love. And I think the essential difference between the two is the essential difference of the old paradigm versus the new paradigm, which we discussed in the previous session. Love is not a mere emotion, even though it can be experienced as an emotion. Love is the experiential knowledge of unity. It's the experience of connectedness with everything and everybody. In the Vedic tradition, of course, love has cosmic connotations in that love is the experience of connectedness. Love between a man and a woman, love between a father and a child, a mother and a child, love between people in general, or love with nature, they're all expressions of that one unity that connects us all. So even though love can be experienced as an emotion, ultimately it is the truth which is really binding everything and everybody and running the galaxies and organizing the infinite intelligence of nature. And therefore, true love is ultimately an experience of a higher state of consciousness. When you give somebody attention without evaluation, without judgment, you're expressing true love. True love comes when we don't expect anything in return for what we give. And that can only come if you think or believe or see people as an extended form of yourself. And therefore, the essential difference, once again, between fear and love is that in fear, one feels alienated, separated, isolated, different, fragmented from wholeness. And in love, one is just connected with everything and everybody. It's an experience of unity consciousness. The great poet Rabindranath Tagore from India, he said, love is the ultimate reality. It is the truth at the heart of all creation. And therefore, true love can only come through evolution into a higher state of consciousness. To me, one of the most important experiences is the experience of transcending. I practice transcendental meditation myself. I've done it for over 10 years. And with that experience of silence, one spontaneously feels connected with people, with things, with nature. We cannot manipulate our emotions, as I said earlier. But when we begin to silently witness them, then spontaneously there is a change that comes about. And that spontaneity is the most essential aspect of the experience of love also. Another factor that influences biological aging is the role of toxins in the body. These are now understood as free radical compounds. That's the technical name for them. And they are oxygen, singlet oxygen, that is oxygen as a single atom without the molecule, something called hydroxy radical, hydrogen peroxide, and another substance called lipid peroxide. It seems that these four toxins are the ultimate mediators of more or less all disease and even aging. These free radicals get generated as a result of stress or environmental pollution or eating the wrong kinds of food. And when they accumulate in the body, they cause aging and entropy. In fact, they are responsible for entropy even in the environment. For example, when meat putrefies, it's because of free radicals. When your car rusts, that's because of free radicals. When there are holes in the ozone layer, that's because of free radicals. When there are pesticides in food, they get converted to free radicals. So we can very safely say that there's a good understanding of what the final expression of entropy or disorder in the body is due to. It's due to the generation of these free radicals. The ideal situation, of course, would be not to generate the free radicals. And that would be if we were living in an environment that didn't have any pollution, or if we were stress-free, or if our food was pure without any additives or preservatives or carcinogens, which are frequently present in food, then that would be the ideal situation. However, since that ideal situation is not present, there is a lot of research that shows that it is possible to remove these free radicals from the body through the use of what are known as free radical scavengers. Free radical scavengers are natural compounds, and they are basically vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, riboflavin, which is a whole category of B2 vitamins, and certain other compounds known as catechins. And the research also shows that if you take vitamins in the form of pills, even though they have the ability to scavenge the free radicals, they are not as effective as food that is rich in these same vitamins. Essentially, there's no difference between synthetic vitamins and so-called natural vitamins. Both are effective, but they are not as effective as the foods that are cooked or raw that contain those vitamins. And the foods that are extremely rich in these vitamins, in these free radical scavengers, are basically citrus fruits, also broccoli and spinach and the green leafy vegetables, and fruits in general. Fruits in general are very rich in free radical scavengers. Therefore, I always suggest to my patients that they should make at least 50 to 60% of their total intake of food in this category. Fruits and fresh vegetables, green leafy vegetables, should comprise at least 50% of the total intake of food. These are also foods that are very rich in their water content, and it's very useful to have that water content in food also, because 60 to 70% or more of our body is basically water. Other than that, there are also herbal compounds that are extremely rich in free radicals.
Abkhazia is a remote mountain region of southern Russia. It is a land of almost mystical old age, and it's the only place I have ever heard of where there's a separate word for great-great-great-grandparents. And this word is applied only to the living, not to someone who has died. It's been reported that the rural villages of Abkhazia, almost all of them illiterate field workers, have reached incredible ages of 120, 130, and even 170 years old. Abkhazia boasted 5 times more centenarians than any part of the world. These people were referred to as the long living. The word old was never applied to them. Even past their 100th year, 80% were active and vigorous. It was common for both men and women to work in the local tea fields for decades beyond the official retirement age of 60. Champion tea pickers were given certificates when they reached 100. In fact, the concept of sedentary retirement was unknown except in cases of disability. Typically, older workers shortened their hours in the fields as they approached 80 and 90. Instead of laboring for 10 to 15 hours, they might quit after 3 to 5. Yet this toil was not forced on them. Love of hard work was deeply ingrained amongst the Abkhazians, and records showed that a woman of 109 was paid for 49 full work days in the tea fields one summer. The people of this region subsisted on homegrown vegetables and dairy products, together with small amounts of nuts, grains, and meat. Total intake of fat and calories was unusually low by Western standards, between 1,500 and 2,000 calories a day, despite the fact that people routinely walked distances of up to 20 miles. In America, we are facing a huge increase in all age groups over 65, and so the long-living Abkhazians are more and more fascinating to us. In their culture, the new old age has existed for generations. They traditionally led lives in which all the right ingredients came together for conscious, purposeful longevity. Not just the longevity of survivors, but of youth in old age. Abkhazians struck Western visitors as remarkably attuned to the rhythms of life, precisely what we've lost in this country. One gets the sense of a people who have reached a natural balance. Rather than struggling to break unhealthy habits, their culture has woven good health into their overall view of life. In every society and in every person, expectation rules outcome. In a culture where wealth is the highest goal, the entire society will focus on making money. Prestige will accrue to those who make the most, and the poor will be regarded as failures. In Abkhazia, a great value was placed on longevity. Therefore, the entire society felt motivated to live up to that ideal. In America, the reverse is true. Old age is not valued, much less exalted. Yet this country has recently experienced an unparalleled boom in centenarians. The number of Americans who are over 100 is currently estimated at almost 36,000, double what it was 10 years ago, and expected to double again before the year 2000. Clearly, we are winning the struggle for biological longevity, and we now face the challenge of becoming a land where the long living are still young. What will it take to meet this challenge? First, we must recognize that everyone grows more unique with age, and uniqueness includes the possibility of improvement on any front. We are constantly making and unmaking our bodies at the quantum level, which means that we are constantly unfolding hidden potential. The field takes a neutral attitude. What we wish and expect for ourselves is what we get. If we consider how to improve physical and mental function every day for the rest of our lives, three values emerge that must be part of everyone's intention. First, longevity itself, since life is a primary good. And second, creative experience, which keeps life interesting, makes us want more of it. And third, wisdom, which is the collective reward of long life. It's impossible to set limits on what can be achieved in each of these areas. Psychologists who study creativity say that artists and writers often can produce more new ideas in their 60s or 70s than in their 20s. One interesting variable is that the later you take up any creative pursuit, the more likely you are to pursue it into old age. Creativity and wisdom inspired Picasso, Shaw, Michelangelo, Tolstoy, and other long-lived geniuses to the day they died. A sense of active mastery is the ego state most clearly associated with longevity. Active mastery means having autonomy over one's life and the circumstances of one's life, not power over others. Beyond any body of evidence about aging and how to prevent it, the single most important factor is that you make something creative from your existence. That means the most meaningful thing you can live for is to reach your full potential. At any given age, the body and mind you experience are but a tiny fraction of the possibilities still open to you. There are always infinite new skills, insights, and depths of realization ahead. Yet sadly, these latent potentials are closed off to the vast majority of people who barely have the living skills to fill 65 years of existence. Therefore, it's extremely important to begin to develop your skills consciously, breaking free of social expectation and setting yourself the goal of becoming a master. To help you carve out your own ideal life, I'm going to suggest 10 keys to active mastery. They summarize much of what we've learned so far about aging and awareness, and they could just as well be referred to as the 10 keys to a happy life. They are also meant to be practical ideals, ones you can aspire to in action every day and every stage of life. 1. Listen to your body's wisdom, which expresses itself through signals of comfort and discomfort. When choosing a certain behavior, ask your body, "How do you feel about this?" If your body sends a signal of physical or emotional distress, watch out. If your body sends a signal of comfort and eagerness, proceed. 2. Live in the present, for it is the only moment you have. Keep your attention on what is here and now. Look for the fullness in every moment. Accept what comes to you totally and completely so that you can appreciate it, learn from it, and then let it go. The present is as it should be. It reflects infinite laws of nature that have brought you this exact thought, this exact physical response. This moment is as it is because the entire universe is as it is. Don't struggle against the infinite scheme of things. Instead, be at one with it. 3. Take time to be silent, to meditate, to quiet the internal dialogue. In moments of silence, realize that you are recontacting your source of pure awareness. Pay attention to your inner life so that you can be guided by intuition rather than externally imposed interpretations of what is or isn't good for you. 4. Relinquish your need for external approval. You alone are the judge of your worth, and your goal is to discover infinite worth in yourself, no matter what anyone else thinks. There is great freedom in this realization. 5. When you find yourself reacting with anger or opposition to any person or circumstance, realize that you are only struggling with yourself. Putting up resistance is the response of defenses created by old hurts. When you relinquish this anger, you will be healing yourself and cooperating with the flow of the universe. 6. Know that the world out there reflects your reality in here. The people you react to most strongly, whether with love or hate, are projections of your inner world. What you most hate is what you most deny in yourself. What you most love is what you most wish for in yourself. Use the mirror of relationships to guide your evolution. The goal is total self-knowledge. When you achieve that, what you most want will automatically be there, and what you most dislike will disappear. 7. Shed the burden of judgment. You will feel much lighter. Judgment imposes right and wrong on situations that just are. Everything can be understood and forgiven, but when you judge, you cut off understanding and shut down the process of learning to love. In judging others, you reflect your lack of self-acceptance. Remember that every person you forgive adds to your self-love. 8. Don't contaminate your body with toxins, either through food, drink, or toxic emotions. Your body is more than a life support system. It is the vehicle that will carry you on the journey of your evolution. The health of every cell directly contributes to your state of well-being because every cell is a point of awareness within the field of awareness that is you. 9. Replace fear-motivated behavior with love-motivated behavior. Fear is the product of memory which dwells in the past. Remembering what hurt us before, we direct our energies toward making certain that our old hurt will not repeat itself. But trying to impose the past on the present will never wipe out the threat of being hurt. That happens only when you find the security of your own being, which is love. Motivated by the truth inside you, you can face any threat because your inner strength is invulnerable to fear. 10. Understand that the physical world is just a mirror of a deeper intelligence. Intelligence is the invisible organizer of all matter and energy. Since a portion of this intelligence resides in you, you share in the organizing power of the cosmos. Because you are inseparably linked to everything, you cannot afford to foul the planet's air and water. But at a deeper level, you cannot afford to live with a toxic mind because every thought makes an impression on the whole field of intelligence. Living in balance and purity is the highest good for you and the earth. Life is a creative enterprise. There are many levels of creation and therefore many levels of possible mastery. The later years should be a time when life becomes whole. The circle closes and life's purpose is fulfilled. In that regard, active mastery is more than a way of surviving into extreme old age. It's the true road to freedom.
The next factor that influences the aging process is relationship. There's ample research that shows how we relate to others, whether it's in our family, in our work, in our social setup. All this influences aging. Now, what does Ayurveda say about relationship? There are some very simple, basic principles. Number one, we can only nourish a relationship. That should be our role. Number two, we cannot change other people by telling them to or trying to make them change. It hasn't worked in the entire history of humanity, so we shouldn't try to do it. Even a war is the ultimate defense of a point of view. You want to change something, and that hasn't worked in all of history. So when we evolve and change ourselves, our environment changes, our relationships change, because in fact our environment is our extended body. It's an expression of ourself. And one of the most important things in relationships that we can do is lose the need to defend our point of view. It doesn't mean that we don't have a point of view. We just are not rigidly attached to defending it. Because after all, life is the coexistence of all kinds of points of view. And as we saw earlier, the mechanics of perception are such, even physiologically, that no two people are going to experience a given reality in exactly the same way. So it is not necessary to manipulate another person's experience of reality. As long as you lose your rigid need to defend your point of view, that in itself will improve the relationship. The three keys to an effective relationship are: don't judge, don't rationalize, and don't defend your point of view. When you stop judging, interpreting, evaluating, analyzing, labeling, defining, describing even, in that silence of non-judgment, spontaneously there is healing and effective relationship. Silence comes because most of the background noise in our brains is nothing other than the noise of judgment. Even though the connection may not seem obvious, we make things happen, even though we may perceive them as happening to us. And rationalization is just an excuse for the experience, basically, of things happening to us. It's a change in perception that is necessary. If we just practice these very simple principles, our relationships become magical. Most people spend their entire life defending that they are correct. So the moment you stop trying to do that, you are approaching defenselessness. Defenselessness is actually the key to invincibility. When you let down all your defenses, there is nothing to attack. It's true that that applies to ourselves also, that we don't judge ourselves, we don't try to defend a point of view to ourselves. I'm reminded of a statement that Mr. Gorbachev made a few years ago to President Reagan. He said, "We're going to do something terrible to you. We're going to deprive you of an enemy." When you let down all your defenses, nobody can attack you because there's nothing to attack. And that really is ultimate power. Ultimate power does not allow the birth of an enemy, and the mechanics of that is simple, effective defenselessness. Just consider the number of arguments you have in a week. That's a good measure of how defensive or defenseless you are. Finally, in Ayurveda, an effective communication involves the understanding of body types. Because, again, different people, depending on their body type, interpret reality in different ways. If we understood how these body types are derived, then it becomes clear that Vata body types, for example, are more responsive to sound and touch. Pitta types are more visual. Kapha types respond more emotionally because emotions are connected with the sense of smell and taste. So it's very important when you're trying to nourish a relationship to know or have some idea of how that person interprets his reality. If the person is a pure Vata type, then they would really understand or communicate much better through words, through sound, and even through touch. If they are Pitta body type, they need to be shown graphically. So they respond more to the written word or to a visual image or to colors. Kapha body types respond to emotions, and emotions also are connected to the experience of taste and smell. Let's assume there is a husband and wife relationship. A Vata person, they need to be touched, stroked, cuddled, spoken to. A Pitta person, they need to be shown through flowers, gifts. That's how you show your appreciation. A Kapha person, you take them out for dinner or you buy them a perfume. You'll find that they respond much more. It's not manipulative. It's just nourishing a relationship by understanding a person's needs. That's what it means. And that is our role in a relationship. So let's move on to another factor that influences aging, and that is the quality and quantity of sleep. After all, we spend one-third of our lives sleeping. And the quality of sleep is that sleep that when you wake up, you feel energetic. You feel that you're bubbling with energy, ready to take on the world? Or do you feel tired when you wake up? Or do you feel unrefreshed when you wake up? This is what we mean by quality of sleep. In Ayurveda, we say that the sleep should be blissful, in that it should be the experience, really, of silence. And also, there is, in sleep, the necessary requirement of the dream state of consciousness. It's known, for example, that people who are deprived of their dream state, they have excessive fatigue and are much more prone to illness. The most frequent causes of deprivation of dreams are things like tranquilizers or sleeping pills or alcohol. These are the most frequent cause of sleep deprivation. That's why when people withdraw from these drugs, they frequently have hallucinations. They're just catching up on their dreams, even in the waking state of consciousness. Now, in dream state, our eyes perform certain movements that are called rapid eye movements. When we are visualizing something, our eyes move up and to the left. In dream state of consciousness, that also happens. And it's very necessary that we have that dream state of consciousness. How is it brought about? How does one improve the quality of sleep? If one has a sleep disorder, it's usually because of Vata imbalance. So anything that will correct Vata imbalance will improve the quality of sleep. Some of the things that one can do if one is suffering from a sleep disorder is eat the foods that pacify Vata. When I refer to sleep disorder, I'm talking about insomnia or absence also of clear dreams, which is part of the blissful experience of sleep. Some people do not remember their dreams, but those people who have the experience of silence more and more, they remember their dreams, and there is a witnessing quality to their dreams also, in that they are dreaming and yet there's a wakefulness inside that is witnessing the dreams. Physiologists have called this lucid dreaming. The better the quality of sleep, the more clear and lucid the dreams become. Treating a sleep disorder such as insomnia involves mainly following a Vata pacifying diet and having a light supper, and it should be about 2 or 3 hours before you go to sleep. Other suggestions for improving the quality of sleep are things like decreasing the sensory input before sleep, in that it shouldn't be too stimulating. So the sensory input should be soft music, perhaps aromatherapy, which is pacifying to vata imbalances. And also there are certain herbs that are very effective in improving the quality of sleep. And these include saffron, 2 or 3 threads heated in a cup of milk just before bedtime, or nutmeg, a large pinch stirred into a cup of warm milk also before bedtime, or an herb called poppy seed, and there's also gotu kola, it's an Indian herb, 1 teaspoon or 1/4 teaspoon of the powder brewed into tea with 1 cup of water. These herbs are all available in health food stores. How about the quantity of your sleep? It varies. A vata type may need only 4 to 6 hours. A pitta type may need somewhere between 6 to 8 hours. A kapha type may in fact need more, even more than 8 to 9 hours sometimes. So the amount of sleep is really based on your body type. The basic thing to remember is when you wake up, you should feel refreshed, you should feel energetic, and you should feel like you're ready to take on the world, take on any challenge. That sense of energy should be there in both body and mind. One of the most important factors that accelerates the aging process is, of course, stress. My definition of stress is that it is the interpretation of psychological or physical threat. It's not something there in the environment. It's not something in you either. Stress is your interpretation of what's happening in the environment. So two people, given the same situation, one could feel exhilarating joy, the other could feel stressed. Two people could be on a roller coaster ride and one person gets exhilaration out of it. He makes these very powerful interleukins in his body. These are anti-cancer drugs. Another person experiences the same roller coaster ride and he's petrified and he experiences stress. He brings about all these chemicals in his body that ultimately result in the generation of free radicals, which we know cause aging and entropy and all kinds of other diseases. Now, there are many researchers who say that there are some kinds of stress that are good for you, and we are just using different labels, basically. If you interpret a situation as threatening to you, then no matter what definition you use, that's stress, and that's not good for you. If, on the other hand, the same situation acquires a meaning of challenge for you or becomes an opportunity for you, then, of course, it's no longer stress. So stress is basically an interpretation of threat. Therefore, stress is an internal dialogue. So although there are many techniques for stress management, and these include music, imagination, visualization, massage, aromatherapy, a change in environment, the experience of laughter, watching a movie, etc., all these are an immediate switch from the perception of threat into another experience. And therefore, they are effective stress management techniques. In my experience, meditation, and particularly transcendental meditation, is one of the most effective stress management techniques because it allows the mind to settle down to more abstract levels of awareness and then ultimately transcend the whole thinking process so that one experiences a state of consciousness which is without thought content. So one has that experience of solitude, of connectedness, of silence, which is the most important experience necessary for us to have because it gives us contact with that part of ourselves which is non-changing, that silent witness aspect of ourselves. Transcendental meditation, incidentally, can be taught in all the cities in the United States. Everywhere there are TM centers, so it's very easy to find out how to learn that. There is ample research on the physiological effects of transcendental meditation, but one of the most important papers was published in the Journal of Neurosciences that showed that those people who had been transcending regularly for more than 5 years, their biological age was about 12 years younger than their chronological age. That's a very astonishing result. And recently, Dr. Ellen Langer and Dr. Charles Alexander published an article in the Journal of Behavioral Sciences that revealed that elderly people who practice meditation regularly live much longer than those who don't. So I think the research is quite unequivocal in the effect of the ability of the experience of silence to create silence in the body, silence in the mind to create silence in the body, as a result even prolong the aging process, and in fact reverse some of the changes that are known to occur with aging. One of the most important factors that influence the aging process is job dissatisfaction. We live in a universe which is like a big jigsaw puzzle, and each part must fit. There are no spare parts in the universe. So we have a very important role to play in this universe, and when we are playing that role, we feel a sense of comfort in our bodies. We feel a sense of comfort in our mind. Essentially, we are referring here to a very basic concept in Ayurveda, and that is the meaning of dharma. Dharma is our purpose in life. We have some purpose that we are here for. If that purpose is not clear to us, then we will flounder. We will go from here to there, and that ultimately also expresses itself as job dissatisfaction. On the other hand, if we know very clearly why we are here, what's our role, we are here for a specific purpose, and that purpose is our dharma. When we are in dharma, then we enjoy our job. We feel a sense of comfort in our bodies, and there is a spontaneous flow to what we are doing. We accomplish things without effort. It's effortless. It's just completely effortless, spontaneous, and it's like swimming downstream instead of swimming upstream. If you really enjoy your work, then it shouldn't cause fatigue, it shouldn't cause stress. And if you don't enjoy it, then it's definitely creating a lot of harmful toxins in your body and generating all these free radicals. These are the final expressions of that. And in fact, job dissatisfaction and self-happiness rating are the two most important risk factors, not only for heart disease, but also for other diseases. And finally, two more factors that we should mention. One is the experience of humor, the experience of laughter. In the past, I have traveled with some great Ayurvedic physicians who are pulse diagnosticians also, and they put their hand on a person's pulse and they diagnose things like laughter deficiency. And their prescriptions to their patients are watch funny movies more frequently, or read comics, or play with children. Learn to laugh. Learn to laugh even at yourself. And finally, our perception of time. Whenever you feel that you have a deadline and it's causing a lot of stress to you and discomfort in your physical body, always pause a little bit and ask yourself what would happen if you didn't accomplish what you have set out to do. Ask yourself, what is the worst scenario? What's the worst thing that could happen if you didn't accomplish the goal in the given period of time? The sooner you lose your rigid attachment to the outcome, you find, in fact, that you can accomplish the goal with much less effort. It is the rigid attachment to the outcome that interferes with the whole process. And if our orientation is not so outcome-oriented, but process-oriented, if you switch your orientation from outcome to process, you can accomplish a lot more by doing a lot less.
There are two aspects to the higher self. One aspect is the individualized bundle of consciousness with its seeds of memory and desire. What people refer to as the body of information or the soul, the individual soul. And then there is another aspect of the higher self, which is the unbounded ocean of consciousness from where these individualized bundles of memory and desire emerge. The sunlight that is shining through the windows in the room that I'm sitting in is expressing itself as all these colors, blue and green and yellow and violet and pink. And the reason it does so is that it is identifying with the objects in this room, bouncing off them and taking on different forms of expression. But it is the same as the sunlight outside my windows, as the unbounded ocean of sunlight outside. In fact, one couldn't separate one from the other. If one did, the colors would disappear and there would be total darkness. So too, the individual causal body is just the manifestation of the universal field of consciousness, the field of pure potentiality, that is now seeking manifestation through individual desires and individual seeds of memory. And so the infinite play of creation goes on and on. Ultimately, experiencer, experienced, and process of experience are all contained in pure potentiality in the field of all possibilities. The whole process of manifestation from nothing to everything is nothing but a shift of attention of this higher self to itself. As this universal consciousness interacts with its own self, it becomes conscious of itself and develops the intellectual idea that there is an observer, a process of observation, and that which is being observed, but in fact they are all one unified wholeness. And then ad infinitum, the observer looks at the observed, becomes another observer, because what we see we become, and therefore that one universal field of intelligence breaks up into an infinity of observers, an infinity of methods of observation, an infinity of forms and phenomena, the objects of perception, when ultimately they're all the same. That universal ultimate ground contains in pure potentiality experiencer, experienced, and the process of experiencing. Physicists regard this phenomenon, they call this symmetry breaking, the unified field of all the laws of nature. As it interacts with its own self, it results in forces of nature. And these forces of nature are forces of information and energy that subsequently manifest as matter, as forms and phenomena. If we are scientifically inclined, then we say, oh, the universe is made up of matter fields, energy fields, transformation fields, information fields, unified field. If we are spiritually inclined, then we say we have a body, we have a mind, we have an intellect, we have an ego, we have a soul, and we have the higher universal consciousness. But it all comes to the same thing. It's just a question of semantics. The observer, the observed, the process of observation, and the wholeness of observer, observed, and process of observation contained in an infinite unmanifest continuum is nothing other than the universal consciousness, the unified field of being from where we all emerge. It is our destiny, ultimately, after playing out all the roles that we wish to play out, after fulfilling all the desires that we fulfill, it is our ultimate destiny to find our home where we really belong, and that is in the continuum of immortality, from where every little bit of mortality appears to emerge. But the mortality is a facade. The mortality is a mask. Go deep enough beyond the mask of mortality, and you suddenly enter the realm of reality, the realm of reality where you experience yourself as unbounded bliss consciousness. And here, any desire can be fulfilled. In fact, the mechanics of the fulfillment of desire are very simple. Step one, you accidentally or consciously slip into the gap between your thoughts, which is your window, the corridor, the transformational vortex that connects the universal mind with the local individual mind. Step two, in the gap, which is your connection with the higher self, release the desire. Step three, relinquish your attachment to the outcome of the desire. Step 4. Stay with the higher self. Delegate it to the cosmic mind. And step 5. Let the universe handle the details. The result is guaranteed. When you do this more and more, and when you see the fruits of desire manifest into your life experiences, then you recognize once and for all that that dimensionless you is the real you, that it is immortal. It is that which fire cannot burn, water cannot wet, wind cannot dry, weapons cannot cleave. It's ancient, it's unborn, and it never dies. To know this at the deepest level of our awareness is to have ultimately all our desires come true, because all our desires are ultimately headed for this goal. To have this is to have true freedom, to become free, to become unbounded. It is to be in bliss. When one is unbounded, then all delusions are broken. In this state, there is no room for regrets, guilts, fears, or even hope. There is neither anxiety nor hope. Both anxiety and hope are born of the imagination and are equally illusory. One is no longer mired in these illusions, but firmly grounded in the reality of pure being. In the simplicity of this pure awareness, there is bliss. It is a bliss of pure light, where one is neither stuck in the past nor in the future. Both have become irrelevant and inconsequential. The right response to every situation is inherent in one's very nature, and life is supremely concentrated in the present, in the eternal present. In this state, the mind is no more. All fear is gone, and there is only love in action. When you are fully aware in your being, you will be in bliss consciously. It is only because you take your mind to be yourself and make it dwell on what you are not that you lose your sense of well-being. The secret of immortality, as mentioned in Vedic texts, is know yourself, and know yourself as the knower of the field, because that's who you are. That's who you are. Dimensionless, spaceless, causeless, timeless, but able to appear in any dimension, in any field of time, in any form of matter. When you have that, then you will experience true bliss and true unboundedness, and it is an experience that everyone deserves to have.